WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello, and welcome to WrestleSpective Radio at FairToFlare.com. I'm Jason Mann, and with me today is Trey Irby of Wrestling Theory. How are you doing today, Trey?
I'm alive. I'm doing well.
That's good. It's good to be alive. The main event is of, which we're doing SummerSlam 2008 today, and the main event is a man who is not alive, The Undertaker, against Edge in a Hell in a Cell match.
And, well, that's kind of a weird twister because he's not alive, but both of the performers in this match are still alive. So, you know, you got to kind of twist it a bit.
Exactly. But this was a pretty big epic feud that they had that really kind of started almost a year and a half before.
Yeah, probably somewhere around I guess it would be WrestleMania was definitely like what it feel like the peak would be, but then they also kind of, you know, added to it, and, you know, and then this kind of was led off by that TLC match at One Night Stand 2008.
Yeah,
in which The Undertaker was banished from the WWE forever.
Yes, forever is a strange word in WWE.
It's like being buried alive.
Yes. Yeah, well, just to summarize, yeah, they it began as I think spring of 07 when Edge cashed in Money in the Bank against Undertaker. Undertaker had to, I think he had an injury and had to take some time off, and then Edge got hurt not that long afterward and had to take some time off. So they kind of revisited it in the fall of 07 when Edge cost Undertaker the title, I think, in a Hell in a Cell match against Batista. Is that right?
I could not tell you at that many moments. I could only remember one thing about this was when Edge vacated the title, he faced off against a man that was in one of the championship matches on this show, the great Khali.
Yes. Yeah, the great Khali became the champion during that time, the wonderful summer of 07 that we all remember so well in professional wrestling.
A lot
of great things happened that year. But anyway, so yeah, basically Edge did a whole bunch of bad things to The Undertaker. Eventually, The Undertaker won the title from Edge at WrestleMania, but then Undertaker eventually was stripped of the title and eventually was banished from WWE, basically because Edge has a relationship with Vicky Guerrero. But then at this point, that relationship is on the rocks a little bit. Edge kind of fooling around a little bit with Alicia Fox. And
it's the debut of wedding planner and dancer and red hair extraordinaire, Alicia Fox.
Yes, and in also, obviously, one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. Her match with Melina, of course, being one of the, you know, great epic, you know, battles of all time.
I think Alicia would say that Melina carried her through that one, though.
Well, clearly.
Yeah. she would be very humble about her achievement of being, you know, one of the greats.
Exactly.
You know, going up to where Taker and Shawn level.
Yeah. But I thought that whole story and that whole time in SmackDown is really interesting. And but one thing, another you know, interesting fact about this Edge Undertaker match is it is the only match to main event to be the final match in a SummerSlam and a WrestleMania, and it did it the same year.
And it was pretty insane. And also, I think like the great thing about these Taker and Edge matches also were they also didn't have like the taint of a you know, a Cena Orton match to where you're like, not again, quit main eventing this.
Right. Well, like, yeah. I mean, I think part of that was because it was spread. The feud was sort of spread out. I mean, they started it. They had to stop because of the injuries. They kind of went back to it. And, you know, it was definitely, I mean, this was like the fifth pay-per-view, the 5 out of 6 that they did. But they were able to, I don't know, they for some reason, they were kind of able to avoid the, you know, oh, my gosh, we keep doing this over and over again stigma that happens with a lot of WWE feuds.
Yeah, it was, and then it also helps that the angles leading up to it were pretty great, pretty good, pretty great. I, you know, somewhere around there.
Yeah,
certainly, like, it's peaked by the Edge Foley angle.
Oh yeah, yeah. Basically, the deal there is Edge sort of goes to Foley, who's the SmackDown commentator at this point, sort of his short-lived stint there. And he wants Foley to sort of teach him how to, you know, be vicious in the Hell in the Cell and be able to, you know, beat The Undertaker because he feels like he can't do it. And sort of like Foley gives him a bit of a pep talk saying, well, I can't really tell you how to do it. I can't show you and I'm not willing to do it. But the only person who can do it is you. And then he kind of, you know, gets, you know, you're the maniac who I fought at that WrestleMania match. And so forth. And then, you know, he sort of says, do you understand? And Edge is like, I understand. And then he basically destroys Foley. And I believe that was Foley's last appearance in WWE.
I believe so.
Yeah.
What ends up being a great little recurring theme about this feud is that it's really, like, for lack of a pun, it is really a trial by fire. Like, just basically everything that kind of happens to where Edge kind of needs to be really violent to get to that level, and then of course by the end of the match, we have another, in this case, a literal trial by fire.
Yes, exactly. So this is right around, I guess it would have been around WrestleMania when the PG era was really being pulled into full effect. So this is the first Hell in the Cell without blood, I believe. Which, you know, just sort of...
Actually, wait, that's not entirely true, because I do remember that there was, like, a really key spot right around the point when they bust out the cage, and you could see, like, Taker's arm was pretty well cut up. Well,
okay.
I guess it would be the first one where it was not, like, you know, where they weren't trying to emphasize he's bleeding all over the place, you know.
Yeah, there was no bleeding, or there was no, you know, it wasn't like they were bleeding from the head, or there wasn't massive blood. I guess there was a little bit of blood, but yes, it wasn't like, it was definitely very toned down in that sense from the other Hell in the Cells.
Yeah,
but I still, it is really I mean, strong match. I think, I mean, it's one of the better SummerSlam main events, and is a strong Hell in the Cell match. I mean, there have been so many great ones. I don't think it's like in the top five, but it's probably at the next, you know, in the next five or so, you know, if you were going to rank them.
It really made the card worthwhile watching, which is even stranger because, like, Batista and John Cena was also a match on this card, not nearly as good as the build up to their Mania 26 match,
right,
which accidentally ended up being, I wouldn't say accidentally. Actually, it really was a really good match.
Yeah. Although the Batista Cena build up, I kind of liked that as well. I mean, it was a babyface versus babyface thing, but it was their first. I believe it was their first match against each other, and it was just very much kind of like a who's better than thing. And it was also a really good match. It kind of showed how they had their early chemistry. And the thing that I mentioned, you know, of course, Undertaker and Edge being the headliner of both those shows. It might have been the biggest match on this show. You could maybe argue Cena Batista, that might have been close, but it was certainly bigger than the title matches, which were Triple H, Great Khali, and CM Punk, JBL.
Those title matches, a stat I actually had that interested me a lot was that all three of the three brands at the time, being, you know, Raw, SmackDown, ECW, all three of their main title matches, the amount of time that they wrestle combined is still shorter than Undertaker Edge was.
Yes, which is a 26-minute match, which, you know, is a good length match. But yeah, they definitely were emphasizing the, you know, the feuds that really weren't for the titles. That was kind of during the early Punk experiment, which, you know, was hit or miss, I think.
And, no, and not only that, admittedly, and when I say that, I'm not saying that it's like there needs to be more wrestling in your title matches.
Right.
Yeah, because I really want to see more wrestling from the matches on this card, I believe. CM Punk versus JBL for the World Heavyweight title, and Triple H versus The Great Khali for the WWE title.
Yeah, you want to keep those Great Khali matches as short as possible.
A little short. I would have probably reversed the Matt Hardy, Mark Henry, and Triple H Khali match a bit, because that one went, because the Matt Hardy, Mark Henry match went a half a minute.
Yeah.
And you would think that that one's going to, you know, should probably get a little bit more time.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
Triple H and Khali, do you really have to do much other than, like, he nearly chokeslammed him? No, he didn't. Pedigree him.
Yeah. This SummerSlam as well, we're going off subject, but who cares? This also had the best thing on the show, which would have been Chris Jericho punching Shawn Michaels' wife by accident.
That's right. That was on the show. Basically, yeah. the whole big retirement speech, which in weird hindsight, I almost got a kind of the sense that maybe Shawn was Shawn the character was halfway legitimate about that.
Yes,
because of all the things that ended up happening to him afterwards. Apparently he didn't have any money, so yes. He probably had to keep wrestling to work.
Right,
and then eventually he had to be like, "Oh, this is it. This is over."
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. I mean, that's if you haven't seen that Michaels Jericho segment for some reason, you need to seek it out, because it's one of the most outstanding things you'll ever see. But
very, very good stuff.
Yes. Anyway, but back to the Undertaker Edge match, which, again, also very good. One weird thing is that the La Familia stable, which is Chavo, Vicky, Bam Neely, and I think the Hawkins and Ryder. Yeah. First of all, like, that is another in the line of, like, weakest, like, weak SmackDown stables, like, that you could ever possibly, like, come up with. Like, you got JBL's,
it really was.
You got JBL's cabinet. You have, you had Team Angle, which wasn't, well, the first Team Angle was
Team Angle, actually. Yeah, Team Angle during the first run, especially.
Yeah.
They built up Charlie Haas and Shelton Benjamin to where.
Yeah, but then there was another Team Angle, and it was like,
that Rene Dupree and Kenzo Suzuki, or am I misremembering that?
No, I think it was Horseshoe, who had a different name, but,
Luther Reigns, whoever, and maybe Mark Jindrak?
Yeah, I think that's what it was, yeah, so.
Collection of perfection.
Right. SmackDown has had a trouble with goofy stables throughout the years. And usually they're sort of aligned with the authority figures or obviously the main heels in the show.
It's even weirder, even kind of extended to now, if you consider the whole core thing a bit of a failure.
Yeah, I think that was more... That was just more.
It wasn't goofy,
it was played out, and they weren't really ever the main focus of the show. They're definitely not a. I wouldn't call them a huge success or anything. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And okay, the other weird thing, of course, and I understand it based on the story, but they're all cheering for Undertaker, like they're against Edge. Because
I thought what was funnier about it was that they would go to like the shot of it. They'd see like the two times that they cut to La Familia in the back. They were looking at it. In the most stoic, not stoic. They're looking at it like they're watching the Today Show.
Okay.
They're just kind of just looking at this like, oh, this is normal behavior. We're seeing this woman's husband, I suppose, at the time. I guess they didn't have the divorce angle yet.
Yeah.
Husband at the time get demolished. Well, this is normal behavior, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this was toward the end of Edge and Vicky being really effective, because when they kind of went back to it and then had them in the relationship again and then had the more of the drama with that, I kind of thought like that was one too many times, you know?
Yeah, when they did it on Raw, it just didn't feel like... I think the thing that benefited the angle, especially with the Edge and Vicky, was basically at the time, Edge was the entire show of SmackDown for a good 5-6 months or at least... to a year period where Edge was, well, I guess other than maybe like Batista, but people weren't really taken to Batista as much. He'd also be really hurt at times. Same with Taker. And so Edge, they kind of had no other choice but to put Edge up as the focus of the show. And that's really the only way the whole heel GM dynamic really works is if you have a heel superstar who keeps getting all these breaks, so everyone hates him and all that. That's really the only way at least I could feel like I could tolerate a heel GM.
Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, I think sort of either like the corporate champion kind of thing, or the guy who sleeps his way into power or manipulates his way into power kind of thing. Those are the two things. I mean, I think the GM, even in those instances, I think the heel GM thing is pretty much played out, or really GMs in general, I think, are played out. I don't think you really need the authority figures. I think you can pretty much do without them, but I don't think they're going away anytime soon. So
I suppose the closest thing they're getting to any sort of subversion of a heel GM figure is at least attempting something with maybe the Raw GM. To where they're just like, okay, well, we don't have a character. Well, I guess we'll just have the announcer refer to this anonymous guy.
Right.
Who is not there because of, you know, presumably because he doesn't want to get hurt, which actually would be an intelligent decision if you were a general manager.
Yes.
Surely you would not want to actually be in the arena trying to negotiate with these violent wrestlers that almost always tend to hurt people.
Yeah. You know, what I honestly like, and it happened around this time, was when Mike Adamley was GM.
I was going to say that.
Because like, here's the thing about Adamley was the character, he was trying to do the right thing. Like, he was always trying to do the right thing. He just didn't understand what it was. And
the things he didn't really seem to understand how to perform correctly, but you know.
Well, I mean, I think some of that was just natural. Yeah, he was not a great performer, and some of that was they sort of wrote that character to be that at a certain point too. But yeah, I thought that was kind of a cool, like, you know, he's trying to do the right thing for the fans, and he's trying to be a nice guy. And his strength was that he was kind of a nice guy, but he just didn't quite get it.
His weakness was that everyone judged him on his performance and not his ability.
And Jericho, I like the way that Jericho was kind of able, when he was champion, which is the kind of the period that I remember, which wasn't just a couple months after this, you know, he was able to sort of manipulate Adamley, and he's like, oh, you need to treat me well, and I'm your champion, and blah, blah, blah. And I just thought there was, I don't know, that was a different dynamic that I kind of enjoyed, and for whatever reason.
And we must give him, elite credit for the main event of the pay per view after this, the Adamley original championship scrambles.
Yes.
He was a very smart man.
He was
so smart that the other two GMs immediately had to take his idea and process it as their own.
Exactly. Yeah.
What an intelligent fella.
And it allowed us to have Brian Kendrick be interim WWE champion.
Yes! I was going to say that. This might accidentally become like an Unforgiven 2008 report, but like the aftermath of, you know, basically to spoil the match, as it turns out, Edge loses and he goes away.
Yes.
So basically the aftermath of that ends up being that they were really experimenting with, okay, who's going to be the next main eventer? Who's going to be the next main eventer heel? Who is a heel? Because if I remember that match right, there was about three of them. And anyways, let's get back to this match.
Okay.
And I found it really interesting. Like I kind of just put random notes. Like Taker was really, really awesome in this match. I feel like Taker and Kurt Angle are really good masters of the, oh God, it's almost three, he kicked out spot, you know, where JR can probably be like, he kicked out, you know, and scream it like, how the hell did that happen? Because Taker, like knowing the outcome of the match, Taker still is really, really good at making you think, was that a mistake? Was that really a three count? Was it? No, it wasn't. And then going on with the match.
Yeah.
He's really, really awesome at that. And he did that quite a few times in this match, obviously, because, you know, it's a really violent match.
Yeah.
And then my other high point of it was, after all this great damage had occurred, Taker's biggest point where he was really, like, shaking, like he was, like, you know, done for, was when he got low-blowed by Edge.
Yes.
Which I found really funny.
Yes.
Especially considering, you know, I don't think dead men have feelings there, perhaps. I don't know. I can't be an expert on that subject of zombification, but.
No. I honestly have nothing to do there. I cannot add anything to that.
You cannot confirm or deny this. No,
I cannot. No, I don't have my degree is in something else. So.
And then my other favorite line I think was I'm sure this is like towards like the later portion of the match. Key spots being they break through the cage, and then like the big giant spot of the match was they had like the three announce tables set up for the three brands because that was how they did the announcing at the time, and they had Edge run, I think it was either like on Raw or SmackDown stable, run through that, and he landed basically on SmackDown stable, but Heat and Taker landed fully and broke ECW stable, mm-hmm. and it was a pretty awesome spot. That was like it wasn't. I mean, admittedly, I feel like it didn't really cheapen the match that they showed the Foley spot before the match.
Right.
Where everyone would expect. There was this big epic spot, but it was a really, really, it was really well delivered. Like, all the spots they planned in that match seemed to go pretty well.
Yeah, definitely. And they were violent without mostly, for the most part, being super dangerous spots.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, but they were physical. They were, and they built pretty well, they sort of, after that low blow and then Edge gets an implant DDT, then they kind of trade some moves. Edge gets a spear and then Undertaker uses the last ride and then Edge uses does the execution on the ring steps. Yeah. And then Edge tries to do the old school rope walk, but then Undertaker pulls him down and Edge crotches himself. And then beforehand, they had sort of set up, Ed just sort of like stacked two tables on, and then they, didn't go to it. But then at this point, they were basically Taker pulled him, and then he dropped him onto those two tables, or he actually choke slammed them onto those two tables. So that was pretty cool. And then then Undertaker hit a spear of his own, and then he grabbed the camera, which harkened back to the Hell in the Cell I mentioned before, where Edge had run in as a cameraman and interfered and used the camera to cost Undertaker the match. So he did that, and then he did a concerto, and then he did the tombstone pile driver, and that was basically the end of the pin. So there was a couple minutes there where basically he's just hitting Edge with everything to get his final vengeance, and then that ended. So. Oh, that was pretty cool. Rather than doing like the out of nowhere thing, this is definitely like the blow off. Like this is the feud. Undertaker is the victor. Edge has been vanquished. It's over.
Well, it was definitely a blow off when you consider the last 4 minutes or so of the pay per view itself.
Yeah,
where Taker's standing tall and he's walking back. And he stares a little bit up at the Titantron.
Yeah.
And he notices that Edge has a little bit of movement.
Yeah. And by the way, that marquee was really, really cool. The way that looked like a theater stage, and it had like the names in the marquee. That was really awesome.
It was really awesome. But I just like the thought of like Taker, his character obviously being wrong. I put him through hell. This cannot be.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to do something about this. And then he takes off, like, he just turns around. He takes off right back into the ring. He, like, shoves the ref, all that. Like, the ref is trying really hard to just reprimand him, but obviously to no avail. And he gets this ladder. He puts Edge on one side of the ladder. And I think he gets another ladder himself.
Yeah.
And he climbs up that, and he just does he like spear him or slam him through that? Or
it was
like,
a choke slam.
Choke slam. Okay.
Yeah.
And then the ring breaks. The ring. Well, there's a hole in the ring, and we just sit there for about 10 seconds, and it's like, oh, that's a cool spot. And then the lights go out. And then you see fire come out of the hole of the ring. And there's silence for about 10 seconds for commentary. And the last words you hear the entire show are Jim Ross saying, "Undertaker has sent Edge straight to hell."
Yes. Yep.
And it was awesome.
Yes.
It was the silliest thing that you could ever see, but it was also, but it did lead to another amazing return that I thought around like Survivor Series time, when Edge suddenly returned in the match. I think this was during the infamous Jeff Hardy gets attacked in the stairwell angle, to where he could not be on pay-per-view, and the main event of our dear pay-per-view, or one of the major matches of our dear pay-per-view, was Triple H versus Vladimir Kozlov.
Yes.
In a featured match that made many worst of the year lists, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Even though I thought it was okay.
Yeah, Triple H really didn't get much help that year. I mean, he had Kali and Kozlov, you know, in SmackDown feuds. I mean, it wasn't exact, you know. Those are tough ones to have great matches with. I mean, he did, you know, he feuded with Edge for a little bit. He feuded with Jeff Hardy, I think, for a little bit, or at least they had some matches. Maybe it wasn't quite a feud, but, you know, cause sort of unfair to lug him with those guys.
I found it, but the reason why I bring that in particular up was, when Edge came back, he came back and he had a little bit of soot on him. As if to say that he came back straight from hell, and he had a nice little beard that he promptly had to shave off, apparently because his girlfriend didn't like it too much.
I see.
And it was a really, really it made something that was utterly silly a little bit more sillier, but it also was kind of a badass way to come back.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely was a cool. Didn't he just win the title? Like, didn't he like randomly win the title that match? That's right. Yeah. So,
because I guess they just couldn't find anything else for Triple H to do. They could not make another monster that he could destroy.
Yeah.
Triple H was really the Hulk Hogan of 2008 SmackDown. Now that I think about it, huh?
Yeah, that's
a weird time.
That is a little bit of a weird time, although not quite as successful as Hulk Hogan
in
general, you know. like I said, I think this is a strong match. It's a really interesting feuding. People don't think about it as being, or at least I don't think about it necessarily as being like one of the big epic feuds in WWE, you know, of like the 2000s, but you can make a case for it. I mean, it was really they had a lot of matches. All of them were, you know, at least good to very good and maybe even great, you know, depending on your feelings on this. Yet it isn't really, I don't know if that's just sort of kind of because it was all on SmackDown and SmackDown, if that's just sort of a victim of it being the secondary show.
It's certainly possible, especially because it seems like people don't, like, even WWE themselves doesn't seem to look at this feud like they looked at the Edge-Cena feud, where anytime the two would face off on television, they would have to air the recap package of here's what they went through for about 3 years.
Yeah.
And then I guess it also, when you're on the show that doesn't have random Kevin Federline cameos during your feud, then I guess you're probably just an insignificant show.
I guess maybe. You are. Yeah. That's a good point. Let's see. One last thing. Well, I was thinking, like, they're talking about having, like, I know they're doing, like, a Bret Hart Shawn Michaels rivalry DVD where they're going to, like, show, like, a bunch of their matches and talk about, you know, and kind of interview both guys. Like, I'm wondering, like, what other guys they're going to do that for. I mean, I imagine Austin Rock is an obvious one.
Oh, very.
Yeah, and in Undertaker Edge certainly could be a candidate for that. I mean, it makes me think of like, okay, well, who's really like the biggest rival for these guys? You know, these guys. If you think about it, I mean, if you're, you know, you could make a case for Undertaker and a lot of guys. Really, I mean, Undertaker, Michaels, you know, but I don't think they're going to repeat guys too often. So I just wonder, like, if you know, would you pick Undertaker Edge for that? If if obviously Michaels has someone else, and you know, maybe you know, I don't know, maybe I don't think anyone really wants an Undertaker Kane DVD.
Well, and the weird thing about Undertaker is he, especially when you think about like the late 2000s, he's had a lot of like really solid feuds that even in some cases you didn't expect to be. Like the Undertaker Batista feud is a really good feud as well. Like even though I doubt they'll make a DVD about that, only because I don't know if they see that one as like the big Undertaker feud. Mm-hmm. Certainly, but like maybe Undertaker Foley. Just because of the Hell in the Cell,
yeah.
Just because of that particular match, just because it like, other than the Undertaker Shawn match, obviously, the Undertaker Foley match really made the stip.
Yeah, yeah. I think that'll be that'll definitely be really interesting. I'm kind of excited for the idea of those DVDs because I think that's a different format and you could do a lot with it.
I wonder. I guess it could be like maybe 5-10 years down the line. Maybe when Angle's gone from TNA and Brock's gone from UFC, maybe a Lesnar Angle DVD would be pretty good too.
Yeah, yeah, you know, or you know Hogan, Flair, you know when they're on a TNA, you know, I mean, there's a lot of options. So
yeah, a lot of great
wrestling. Interesting to think about, but
indeed, anyway. Indeed. So,
any other thoughts on the match or the feud?
I guess the only thought I could think of was that I'm kind of that even though it's a typical smarky sentiment, I was kind of sad that I began to realize that in my viewings of a SummerSlam that Jim Ross is apparently not called this show anymore. And that kind of sucks.
Yeah. He and Taz, it's weird. I didn't really remember him and Taz having that good of chemistry, but I thought they had good chemistry here. You know,
they did really well together. I think Taz has this weird chemistry to where I think when he's with someone that's like, is willing to put up, that's not like Taz tends to be kind of jokey at points. But Jim Ross, it doesn't really, like, you know, go along with that. He's kind of like, you know, he has to be the serious announcer.
Right.
So where when Taz, you know, whereas, you know, a Mike Tenay or even Joey Styles were kind of like too much of their commentary tend to just seem like they didn't care.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're calling the thing with Jim Ross, you're going to care.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to immediately care.
Yeah.
You're going to at least care that you at least sound a little bit close to the quality of Jim Ross. So I think that could be it too.
Yeah.
Or maybe he just really had good chemistry with Michael Cole because he liked him. I don't know.
Who knows? Yeah. But
yeah.
So Trey, why don't you tell everyone a little bit about Wrestling Theory?
It's a nice little Tumblr blog of just a lot of fun general posts. A lot, you know. Sometimes there's a lot of pictures. It depends on the type of day. There's either a lot of pictures or there's, you know, topics about something. And I really like just, you know, writing when I want to, especially. I'm not, you're not going to get, like, you know, these big, overly long recaps of your, of a regular show, which, and I apologize in advance. But when I feel like I do want to write, which for some reason tends to be like once every week or so, I tend to write something that I feel like I'm proud of. And I feel like that's more awesome.
Yeah.
And there's a nice collection of pieces that I'm particularly proud of. It's when you go on wrestlingtheory.tumblr.com, at the top of the page, you will see a thing that says bindings and ebook primer. And I recommend that to, anybody that wants to read about like the past 2-3 months of wrestling, but and hopefully a reasonably intelligent analysis of it. I hope so.
Cool. Please. Cool. And obviously people can follow you on Twitter as well.
Yeah, Wrestling Theory, or you could also follow my account, you know, at Trey Irby, but that's only if you're interested in like me whining about college and me whining about music. So
there's all right. That. Well, Trey, thanks a lot for being on the show and talking about the match with me. And everyone, of course, we're near the end of the SummerSlam countdown series. We appreciate everyone listening. We'll be back tomorrow with CM Punk and Jeff Hardy at SummerSlam 2009 and on from there. So obviously check out WrestleSpective.com and FairToFlare.com. And thanks again for listening, and we'll be back to again later.
Let's be honest. Most wrestling websites suck. BS rumors, schoolyard gossip, plagiarism. It's no wonder why no one believes anything they read on the internet. Well, if you can't get something done right, you might as well do it yourself. Presenting the Fair to Flare Quarterly from the writers of FairToFlare.com and over a dozen other wrestling websites. We're not copy and pasting what we read in some newsletter. This is 100% original content from the best wrestling bloggers on the internet. In-depth analysis of the art of pro wrestling, debate, artwork, and humor. The Fair to Flare Quarterly will raise the bar of what wrestling journalism can and should be. Professionally edited and produced, and every contributor will be paid for their work. Order your copy of the Fair to Flare Quarterly today at fairtoflare.com. The better wrestling media has arrived.